Hi, welcome to All in the Mind. Natasha Mitchell joining you on ABC Radio National. Thanks for your ears. And in a way, radio extends your mind through your ears, doesn't it? Your thoughts reach out into the world as your eardrum beats to the pulse of the radio waves. It's an intimate way of communicating with the help of technology. But what if that's all you had? What if your body was entirely paralysed and you'd lost the ability to speak? How then would you communicate with the outside world? Could machines do the work? Today, Abby Thomas reports on the cutting edge of the brain-computer interface.
Words can't describe the situation I've been left in, an extremely horrific experience that I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. With mind and memory at 100%, external feeling 100%, all my senses are normal. I'm just left, trapped inside this body. All my muscles wouldn't work. Basically, I couldn't talk, which was the ability which went first. Then I couldn't walk, eat, or excrete.
That's part of the sadness and the terrible pain that patients with motor neurone disease experience. And David Niven, who died of motor neurone disease, described it as the worst torture known to man. So basically, you can be completely locked in. Your mind is active and you're thinking, but you're paralysed.
Mind switch is, to many people, an unbelievable phenomenon where, with technology, we're actually allowing people to control devices, say, in their home, for instance, their computer or TV, totally hands-free with their brain. Whilst it sounds unbelievable, we've been doing this now for 10 years. And in fact, there are a number of research groups around the world who are looking at what we call brain-computer interfaces. So basically, the interface between the person and the device or the technology is basically the brain.
Now look what they've gone and done.
To make reality of imagination.
So that people have time to think.
Machines can do the work.
Hooking up brains directly to machines to bypass the body. The motivation for this research is the thousands who live and die in a state of complete paralysis. One trigger can be a massive stroke or major spinal injury, which can produce so-called locked-in syndrome. Another cause is motor neurone disease, which voraciously and progressively destroys the nerves. The tragedy in these cases is that inside the person's inanimate, unresponsive body resides a perfectly aware and thinking mind.
The good sort of generic name is motor neurone disease, and that encompasses all the types of disorders.
Matthew Kiernan is Associate Professor of Neurology at the University of New South Wales and the Prince of Wales Hospital's Institute of Neurological Sciences.
It was originally described by a French neurologist, Jean-Martin Charcot, in the 1850s, and he described it as amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. So lateral sclerosis is hardening of the spinal cord, and amyotrophy is wasting of the muscles. Now, in America, they were very much affected by the death of Lou Gehrig, who was their most famous first baseman. And so in America, it tends to be known as Lou Gehrig's disease or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And in France, they call it maladie de Charcot. And in Australia, we still generally call it motor neurone disease, as all-encompassing.
And how many people are affected in Australia?
We've recently set up the Australian Motor Neurone Disease Registry, and we're estimating that about 1,200 to 1,400 patients are affected by motor neurone disease across Australia, and one Australian dies every day from motor neurone disease.
How does it first announce itself?
It usually announces itself in the form of weakness, most typically affecting the limbs, so for instance some hand or leg weakness. In a rarer group, it affects the bulbar muscles, so the muscles involved with speaking and swallowing. But typically, the first symptom is muscle weakness.
And what happens then?
The weakness progresses to involve other areas of the body. So, for instance, if it began in a hand, it might then spread to involve a foot and a leg, and then subsequently involving the bulbar muscles. So eventually, all muscles are affected, and patients are locked in. So all they can do is they can still move their eye muscles, and they can communicate through eye movements and blinking, but effectively they're completely paralysed.
Now, you said that eventually a person is only able to move their eyes. I mean, what are the implications for that, for communication, for someone who's got motor neurone disease?
Well, it's a very important issue faced by patients with motor neurone disease and their families. So generally, if people are losing their voice, we try various exercises to try and preserve the voice for as long as we can. There are also voice-saving systems so that, for instance, we can get the patients to record various words and phrases that they can then try and play with their hands or fingers if there are other areas of the body that are unaffected. We use speechwriter systems. Ultimately, though, if someone is completely locked in, the forms of communication are extremely limited. We have boards which have letters placed on them, and one a family member or friend holds the board up, and the patient with motor neurone disease will direct their eye at various letters and blink when the letter is correct. So, you know, you could spend 5 minutes spelling out that the patient needs to go to the toilet.
I talk by using a transparent Perspex board about A2 size with the letters of the alphabet spaced out on it. The person holds it up between our eyes, about 800 millimetres apart. I spell out each letter of my sentence using my eyes, similar to a typewriter, with the other person guessing each letter I'm staring at until I've spelled out a whole sentence. Extremely laborious. It's also very difficult, almost impossible, to express yourself or be sarcastic.
The words of Nick Chisholm, a young New Zealand man who became paralysed 6 years ago after a rugby accident. He published his story in the British Journal of Medicine last year with the help of Otago University Professor of Medical Ethics, Grant Gillette. At more than 1,600 words in length, imagine how long it took him to dictate that article. There has to be a better way. One possibility is via a brain-computer interface, where your brain waves are fed directly into a computer as instructions. A simple version allows you to switch on electronic devices like the TV or light switch. It sounds like hocus pocus, but the principle is elegantly simple. One version is the Mind Switch, developed by Professor Ashley Craig at the University of Technology, Sydney.
So what Mind Switch is, essentially, is a closure of the eye for 1 second. So if you close your eyes for 1 second or two, what happens in the brain is quite remarkable. You see a huge change in one of the frequencies in your brain waves, called the alpha wave, or if you want to be technical and impress people at parties, in your 8 to 13 hertz component of your brain wave. And what happens in your 8 to 13 hertz or alpha wave is a huge increase, about 1 to 200-300% increase. And so when you close your eyes, that's a 1. When you open your eyes, that's a 0. So it's essentially a digital approach.
So if people do that at home now, can you feel a change when you close your eyes in your brain?
Well, it'd be nice to think that you could. It's not that reliable. But if you close your eyes for 1 to 2 seconds, you might find that you feel more at peace or more relaxed. Because alpha waves are related to relaxation. They're not fatigue or sleep waves. You've got to go further down the frequencies to theta and delta waves. But alpha waves are alert, awake, relaxed waves. So yes, you might feel more peace, more relaxed.
Okay, so you generate an alpha wave, and how does that translate into an outcome?
What we do is we put electrodes on the brain, on the cortex or on the scalp, only a couple, and those electrodes wait for the right signal. And we have a little device which is close to the electrode on the cap, which is over the electrode, and they wait for the 0-1 signals to occur. And we also have a computer-based software program which, say, for instance, has the house mapped out. If they're in their lounge room and they want to control their TV, the TV is one option that they can select from that. So to turn the whole system on, they close their eyes for 1 to 2 seconds. That activates the mind switch. They then open their eyes and allow the choice to start rotating through the options. And when it comes to TV, it will sit on the TV for 1 to 2 seconds, shorter or longer depending on how skilled you are.
And that's when they blink? That's when they close their eyes?
That's when they close their eyes, and so they select the TV. So the TV options come up.
And how would you start that process all over again if you, oh no, gosh, I didn't want the TV, I wanted the lights?
Well, they just need to open their eyes and allow the thing to rotate through to the end, which is not long, and then it starts again. Or they can turn the whole system off through one of the options and then start again if they wanted to.
So how long would it take to turn the TV on and select the 7:30 report?
It's a very good choice.
Which, of course, what else would you select?
Exactly. We're talking a severely disabled person, someone with no movement below the neck. You often lose your remote. When I lose my remote, I can't work the TV any longer, so I might take half a minute to find the silly remote. But if you're working with the mind switch, it'll take you 30 seconds. So it's actually not too bad.
How many people in Australia are using Mind Switch right now?
It's not widely available at the moment because it's not commercially available. We've been seeking investors in the past, but we are, in fact, the first group in the world to go to clinical trial with what we call a brain-computer interface. And in that trial, we had 10 people, a mixture of severely disabled persons, say, for instance, the quadriplegic, a couple of quadriplegic people, a very severe stroke victim, person with polio. It's a disease not often heard, but she had no movement below the neck, and so on. And we had other severe injuries as well. And so these 10 people actually used it in their own home with their own TVs and loved it.
And what would they be doing otherwise to turn the television on? What is the sort of previous generation of controls?
Well, in the absence of a carer, they would have fairly reliable controls. Like, the idea really is to get a smorgasbord of interfaces and controls, and the Mind Switch adds to that. But what they might use is a suck and puff. That's just a tube which is joined into the system so that when you suck in, that's a one. When you suck out, that's a zero. There could be an eye blink system which is detected through infrared on the face, and that means you have to blink a couple of times to trigger something. But these are, of course, can be very annoying, and quite often they'll lose the pipe that they suck and puff with, or the eye blink one, of course, is annoying because you have to blink. You just try it at home. Try blinking once or two or three, four times, and it's just quite annoying. Voice control was heralded as the way to go, but you do find that when you have severe neurological disability, that up to half of those people have voice disorder. So we really are crying out for the severely disabled. We are really crying out for appropriate interfaces like a Mind Switch.
If you're completely paralysed, being able to turn devices on and off is useful. But what about communication? A more complex version of a brain-computer interface, also known as BCI, allows the user to send emails and so verbalise their inner world. And this one doesn't even need you to close your eyes. You simply think about what you want to do. A guru in the field is Professor Jonathan Walpaw. He heads up the Laboratory of Nervous System Disorders at the Wadsworth Centre in New York State.
What BCIs really do is they allow people to learn how to use brain signals, or generally electrical signals that the brain produces in its normal operation. They provide people the opportunity to learn how to use those signals as a communication channel. We look at electrical activity recorded at the scalp that reflects activity in the underlying brain. So the brain, when it's active, produces very complex electrical fields, but they can be picked up by electrodes placed on the scalp. And this has been done for almost 80 years now for various clinical purposes to diagnose disease and recognize seizures. But it's only very recently that there's been a concerted effort to use these signals as a communication channel, as a non-muscular communication channel. And the important or the unique part of what we and other people in the field do is in the software that analyzes these signals in real time and allows people to do things with the signals.
Okay, so could you take us through exactly what happens? So you're hooked up to this machine and you think a thought, and then what happens then?
Well, it's somewhat more complicated than that. There are a couple of different methods. Depending on the particular signal that we're using, people learn through basically a training process. The signals we look at particularly are signals coming from the parts of the brain that are the parts of the cortex that are most directly involved in actually controlling movements. And we've shown that by using various kinds of motor imagery, imagining various things, moving or not moving, relaxing, floating, running, writing, various things, people can change these signals without actually moving, without any actual movement occurring, just by using movement imagery. They can learn how to change these signals. And we can use these changes in the signals to control a cursor. So they can make a given signal bigger or smaller to make a cursor move up or down. As they learn to do this, this is a skill that they develop over training sessions. And as they learn to do this, the imagery becomes less important. And they learn how to do this really the way you raise your arm. You don't really think about how you raise your arm, you just do it.
There was an interesting example that you gave of one of your subjects who, when he wants the cursor to move up, he thinks of nothing, and when he wants it to move down, he thinks of a traffic light changing?
Yeah, that's one possibility. Yeah, I mean, people come up with their own solutions. As they get better and as they move to controlling things in two dimensions, for example, which is a good deal more complicated, they may not really be able to tell you what they're doing. It becomes more like a normal kind of skill, except it doesn't involve muscles.
What sort of things are we talking about controlling here? You said two dimensions, so...
Well, to take a cursor, for example, on a screen and move it where you want to go, and then even perhaps use an additional kind of brain signal to select an icon when you reach that location.
And what's their reaction when they first start to make this technology work? I mean, is it a
Well, they'd be elated, and you know, they're happy and pleased, and it's something that develops not very slowly, but develops gradually over a number of sessions over the first several weeks. These are sessions in which they spend perhaps 25 minutes actually controlling the cursor, and they gradually acquire control over the first few sessions. And as they continue to practice, it can get better and better.
Now look what they've gone and done.
To make reality of imagination.
So that people have time to think.
Machines can do the work.
Scott Mackler is one of the exceptional people now using Jonathan Wolpaw's brain-computer interface. He was diagnosed with motor neurone disease in 1999. At the time, he was leading a research team at the University of Pennsylvania working on cocaine addiction. Today, despite being confined to a wheelchair, unable to move, speak, or breathe without a ventilator, Mackler still runs his research lab with the help of BCI.
He's actually a very successful research scientist, and he's using this to run his lab. He is on a ventilator. He can't breathe. He can't talk. He can barely move his eyes. What he has left is a little bit of eye movement. But he can, with his predictive speller, he can type, perhaps up to four or five words a minute. To write a couple of sentences might take him 5 or 6 minutes. So it's a lot slower than normal communication, but it restores independence. He has a system which can essentially, it provides him a keyboard, and he can essentially operate any Windows-based program that you can operate with a keyboard. He's using it for email. He's using it to control his TV and his turn the lights on and off and things like that.
To get an idea of how this predictive spelling device works, imagine a keyboard before you with lights flashing across it. As the particular letter you want lights up, so does your brain in a certain way, and instantly the computer recognizes this and picks out that letter for you.
It basically consists of a matrix of letters and numbers. It's essentially a 72-item keyboard, and the various selections on that keyboard flash very rapidly. The system can recognize, by looking at the brain's responses to those flashes, which particular letter or number he wants to select. So that's primarily what he's using.
So he's actually managing a lab.
Yes, part of the system he takes to work with him, and he sets up with the computer there.
So he's not just staying at home and running it remotely. He's actually going physically into the lab.
No. Yes.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
absolutely amazing.
Quite a remarkable person.
He must be extremely persistent. I mean, how long has it taken to him to learn how to use this system?
And... Well, the method he's using, which is the flashing, it's something that requires, I mean, the advantage of that is that it requires little or no training, and basically you need to train the system, which takes 25 minutes or half an hour. In our first efforts at actually getting out of the laboratory and providing this to people, we're focusing on the simpler approaches. Until we get a lot of the other problems worked out. I mean, things like barking dogs and electrical noise from refrigerators and garage doors and the kind of problems you don't see until you're actually out there dealing with, you know, until you actually try to put a system in a home.
Yeah, so there's external stuff as well as internal stuff to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, you have to worry. I mean, these problems can be solved, but you just need to solve them.
And there's the expense as well, I guess. I mean, how much are we talking about?
Well, the hardware and software is not, even at this point, it's... $4,000 or $4,500, and it'll go down with more systems.
Hmm.
It's basically a regular laptop and maybe an extra screen. And the amplifier is the expensive part at this point. It costs a couple of thousand dollars. But that's not the hard part. That's not the expensive part. The expensive part is if we need a great deal of technical support.
Hmm.
So that's what we're trying to learn how to minimize.
Do you think realistically it can get to the point where just a nurse's aide?
Yes, someone who's trained and, you know, has at least access over a phone line to some help.
Hmm.
Yes, I mean, that's sort of what we're dealing with this, the person we're talking about at this time. And another person, the spouse, is taking care of it. And I mean, he has greater limitations than the person who's taking care of the research scientist. He has some vision problems, et cetera, and we're learning how you deal with that and how you simplify the software so that he can use it for and support his wife that way.
Brain-computer interface trailblazer Professor Jonathan Walpole from the New York State Department of Health. On ABC Radio National, I'm Abby Thomas with All in the Mind, also coming to you on Radio Australia and via podcast. And this week, the brain-machine interface for active minds trapped in paralysed bodies, such as those with motor neurone disease.
It felt like I was in a really bad nightmare constantly for about the first 3 months. I could only just hear. I couldn't even open my eyes or breathe by myself. Without them knowing that I could still hear, the doctors and specialists in front of me said to my mum that I would die. They even asked my mum if she wanted them to turn off the life support machine after a few days.
It sounds like an incredibly difficult existence. You mentioned cases that you've been dealing with recently, a family with four children. Can you describe that situation?
Well, in about 90% of motor neurone disease, we call it sporadic or idiopathic, so that no cause is clearly identifiable. In 5 to 10%, there is a genetic mutation affecting the motor neurons that causes motor neurone disease. And unfortunately, this is autosomal dominant, so if you have four children, usually two to three are affected. And in this particular family, four siblings, of those four siblings, three have now died from motor neurone disease, all in their 40s. One died from bulbar onset motor neurone disease. His sister died after developing motor neurone disease affecting her arms, and his other sister died from motor neurone disease affecting their legs. So in that family, three out of four siblings have died from motor neurone disease at a relatively young age. And obviously they have children and they've passed that gene on, and that is going to be an issue for subsequent generations as well.
People with motor neurone disease have a limited time and naturally want to make the most of it. As the disease takes over their body, the challenge is to allow their active minds to stay in touch with the people around them. Neurologist Matthew Kiernan confronts this problem every day. So what does he think of efforts to bypass the paralysed body and tap straight into the brain using computers?
Well, I think it's an extremely promising development, and it will be well regarded by patients with motor neurone disease, and obviously they'd be keen to be involved in any studies. I mean, the reality of the situation at present is that patients here in Sydney do not have access to that form of communication. But, you know, I'm hopeful, particularly with this story and development of the technology, that this sort of form of communication can become more freely accessible to the average Australian who may be afflicted with motor neurone disease.
Do you find that people have different ability to use this technology, or is it something that everybody really has the same ability to use?
You've hit an interesting point there. We often talk in our lab about Mind Switch Olympics.
Really?
Yeah, and some people just are much better at it. So some people have huge switches, and a lot of our research is, in fact, trying to find out why that is the case, and that's fascinating. If you're extroverted, you're more likely to have a huge switch.
Any idea why a more extrovert personality produces bigger alpha waves?
Well, one of the possible theories is that an extroverted person is not as stressed, sort of more relaxed about life, and so mind switch will be bigger. That's one possibility. Now, it's also genetic-based.
The other interesting thing that seems to happen with this technology is that it's a process of the user not only learning to use the computer in the interface, but the computer kind of learning about the user's brainwaves as well. There's kind of a relationship that runs both ways.
Well, you've hit on a very interesting point there, because this is the cutting edge of our science at the moment. What we're trying to do is to develop our technology so that it's emotionally smart. In other words, it sits there and waits for you to have, for instance, if you're frustrated or become angry, it will start to know that, and it may well adjust its performance in relation to that.
So how would you make an emotional mind switch?
Well, we've got to know exactly what the emotions are made up of.
You mean in terms of brainwaves? Or
brainwave or body, physiological factors. Emotions, of course, are all encompassing, you know, there's visual to feeling and to heart and to mouth dry, to stomach feeling strange, to warm hands versus cold hands. So you get arousal. Now, arousal can be high or low, and you get how pleasant that arousal is. So if you have high arousal and unpleasantness, it's anxiety, anger. If you have high arousal and pleasantness, it's excitement.
But does that mean that if you're going to be using this kind of emotional mind switch, you're going to have your body kind of stuck all over with electrodes that are picking up every nuance of moisture and temperature? And
that wouldn't work. We know that. So what we're trying to do in our research is to find the neural correlates of all that.
And so what's the point of a mind switch knowing how you're feeling?
Well, we're quite sure, and we've seen it ourselves, that users become less able to use the mind switch if they're angry or frustrated. You think about it. Can you drive as well when you're frustrated and angry?
Oh, I drive really well when I'm angry.
Yes, we think that experiencing anger or frustration or even boredom and fatigue will incapacitate or lower the capability of the person using mind switch.
So you're talking about maybe the system being able to temper its functionality, perhaps?
Possible.
Slow down its functionality,
yes, yes.
So that the person's got
easier.
A chance. Make it easier.
Make it easier, yes. That's one option. Other options people are using, more engineering-based systems, the machine talks to you and tries to counsel you. Yeah, so that's one potential response.
It's not hard to imagine what this technology could mean for a person trapped inside a motionless body. Unfortunately, the mind switch device that Professor Craig spoke about earlier is not yet commercially available. So it remains a waiting game.
I feel extremely sorry for anyone with this syndrome who is scared of taking risks. Most things I do entail some form of risk, even something simple such as eating. As it is in everyone's life, change is optional. I can choose to stay bedridden, wither away and eventually die. Don't will for death, it'll come to you. Just sometimes, sooner than expected.
Well, the psyche is very important, and for people who want to remain as active and to fight the disease, they come up with various strategies, and it's amazing how they can preserve their very small things are critical for their quality of life, and they fight to maintain their independence.
So what can they do to maintain a healthy mind, if not a healthy body?
Well, I think in this world of internet and communication, definitely the computer has been a key form of communication, and patients continue to communicate using, for instance, emails rather than telephone if they can't speak or lift up the telephone. You know, patients interact with each other around the world, so if there are various research studies going on or interventions, the patients usually, you know, often hear about it before their treating neurologists or neuroscientists find out about it through various communications on the internet.
Associate Professor Matthew Keenan. So where are we with assistive technologies and the revolution that brain-computer interface technology promises?
When you get to those people who are what we call locked in, there's not many options. Most of the assistive technologies for severely disabled rely upon some movement of the hand or arm. There are very few reliable hands-free systems.
So what do you do with people who come to you and say, can I use this? I mean, can I buy it?
Well, apart from getting a little bit sad and depressed about it because it's not commercial, we try to send them off to companies that do look after them well and use probably more basic assistive technologies. Which will give them some independence.
Mm. Yeah. Any idea when this is going to be commercialised, the mind switch?
Well, unfortunately, international and national investors don't see a great future in terms of money in investing in assistive technology, and they don't make much money out of it, so you'll find that this is essentially the case. You'd have to have some application, which we were working on, say, for instance, military, which would open up the coffers and then the assistive technology would learn off that.
Right on the back of a NASA budget.
Yes, that's possible in the future.
Ashley Craig there, Professor of Behavioural Sciences at the University of Technology, Sydney. And he was speaking with Abby Thomas, who produced today's show. And good luck, Ashley, with securing that funding from NASA. Got to stay ambitious. Lots to read on the cutting edge of brain-computer interface technology. Head to our website for more, abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind. We've popped up some links to info and discussion groups about motor neuron disease and locked-in syndrome. And you'll find the audio of the show, podcastable and downloadable there as well, along with the transcript later in the week. Thanks this week to Nick Chisholm, Grant Gillette and to Mark King for the reading, and to sound engineer Jen Parsonage. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Looking forward to your company next week, where it's part animal, part human brains. Until then, stay wired.
Another podcast brought to you by ABC Radio National, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's network of ideas, broadcast and podcast worldwide. Science, health, history, religion, arts, social and current affairs. More than 60 shows to feed your mind. Delve deeper at abc.net.au/rn.